Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again.
And welcome back. And it is now or never. And we're in the throes of the Virginia ratification debates. Now, these happen to be my favorite, my personal favorite. So we left off, actually, and we have Paul Venable with us. So welcome back, Paul.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
And so we have left off. We were on Tuesday, June 10th, and this was George Nicholas in a kind of a long dissertation. So he goes through a few different things, and we just left off with the general defense and welfare, and he's about to start talking about taxes. And so if you've got that and you're ready to go, let's see what he has to say about the taxes.
I have it and I'm ready to go.
Awesome.
Here we go. The taxes for paying that proportion shall be laid and levied by the authority and direction of the legislatures of the several states, within the time agreed upon by the United States in Congress assembled. Now, sir, by a comparison of this article with the clause in the Constitution. Quick question. I'm sorry to interrupt right in the middle of this.
No, go ahead.
I think he's quoting from the Articles of Confederation, and he's comparing it to the Constitution.
Yes,
right?
Correct.
Okay. All right. So now, sir, by comparison of this article with the clause in the Constitution, we shall find them to be nearly the same. The common defense and general welfare are the objects expressly mentioned to be provided for in both systems. The power in the Confederation to secure and provide for those objects was constitutionally unlimited. The requisitions of Congress are binding on the states, though, from the imbecility of their nature, they cannot be enforced. The same power is intended by the Constitution. The only difference between them is that Congress is, by this plan, to impose the taxes on the people, whereas by the Confederation, they are laid by the states. The amount to be raised and the power given to raise it is the same principle. The mode of raising only is different, and this difference is founded on the necessity of giving the government that energy without which it cannot exist. The power has not been reprobated in the Confederation. It ought not to be blamed in the proposed plan of government.
Okay, so did you see what he basically said here? The only difference between them is that Congress is, by this plan, to impose the taxes on what?
He says on the people.
On the people. Whereas by the Confederation, they were laid by the states. Congress is to lay and impose the taxes, where in the Confederation, it is the states that are to impose the taxes. In other words, Congress puts out a requisition that they need so much, and then the states are supposed to fulfill that. So, in other words, this was the federal government's ability to direct tax and enforce direct taxation.
Okay, so the government was given the ability to enforce direct taxation if it needed it.
Correct? Well, so the process, in duties, yeah, that is correct, correct, because they actually have three mechanisms of taxation. Mm-hmm. And so the first... The first attempt in the taxation. See, the federal government, the new general government under the Constitution, had debt. They already had debt. And
right.
That debt was the debt of the Confederation. However, who was supposed to pay that debt?
Well, I guess the states were supposed to pay that debt.
That's right.
They didn't.
And, well, so actually what happened is Hamilton came along. And in 1792, he did something about that. He did the Assumption Act. And this is what really pissed off a lot of states, because a lot of states said, we've already paid that tax. So in other words, the debt and everything else, the federal government basically kind of assumed that. Hamilton violated the Constitution by doing that. But nevertheless, he, at that point in time, he now created a true and significant debt for the federal government, which gave him finally the power to start invoking taxes.
When you say him, you're speaking of
Hamilton.
Madison.
I'm speaking Hamilton. Of Hamilton.
Hamilton.
He was Madison. The Secretary of the Treasury at the time. And,
okay.
And so, you know, the federal government didn't have that much of a bill. So whatever impost that they were laying, you know, that was more than sufficient to cover their costs. So he needed to step that up. He needed to step up his game. And the best way to do that would have been via, you know, spending money or taking on debt. And so he took on debt. Spending money is the same thing, but he took on debt so that he now had the ability to really create a taxing system so that, you know, he had the machinery working. Where, when I say the machinery, the tax machine. It's because now he basically started levying this taxation where all the those states who had paid up their debt had to now pay more money for the same purpose. So anyway, the two key things here is that, one, that Congress actually had a direct tax. When people said, and you hear, I should say, when people argue that under this system they weren't to tax directly, actually that's not true. They had the power to tax directly. It's just that their taxation went to the states directly, which was then to tax the people. Instead, the old Confederation, they didn't have the ability to tax. As a matter of fact, the reason I'm making really some political hay or some, you know, oration on this is how many times you see people have these memes that taxation is theft.
All the time. I disagree with them regularly, but I see them all the time.
Right, and they all argue that the Constitution does not have the authority. The government's not supposed to do this. Well, they go through this in painstaking effort, talking about taxation, direct taxation, that the federal government under this Constitution did have the ability of direct taxation. The only difference was, with the 16th Amendment, is they just shifted that direct taxation to the people. And the problem with that was they created, and actually, they actually created the IRS at that point. And they didn't have, here's a question for you.
Well, I've got one.
Too, so in Article 1, Section 8, all powers that are given, then Congress has the power to make necessary and proper laws to carry out the execution of that power, right? And so they have the power now under the 16th Amendment to actually tax a direct tax to the people. Now, they don't have the ability to, you know, create a system where one person pays a heavier burden than another person. It's to be uniform, because the requirement in Article 1, Section 8 was not amended on the uniformity. It was only changing the mechanism of where the tax requirement went. Instead of it going to the states, then the people, it went straight to the people. And so is the federal government within in creating the IRS, was that within the power given of the 16th Amendment?
I don't know that it was. Let me take a look at it. I guess they needed a mechanism no, I don't think so. Do you?
So why do you say that?
Well, okay. I'm looking at it right now. So, I think because it created, because the powers in Congress, not the creation of an executive agency, correct?
Okay, so this is what it says. The Congress shall have power to lay and collect taxes on incomes from whatever source derived without apportionment among the states and without regard to any census or enumeration. Okay, so in other words, they had the ability to actually lay out these taxes to directly to the people, but it doesn't say anywhere where they have the authority to change the execution of this law. Article 1, Section 8, I think it's 15 or 16, somewhere in there, 17, Congress shall have the power to call forth the militia to execute the laws of the Union.
Okay.
So, in other words, for them to actually say, we want to create an IRS and to do this and get the approval from the states to be able to use the IRS, they needed a clause in there to actually include that. So there's two problems with the 16th Amendment. First off, it doesn't address the uniformity, and nor does it address the ability to create a standing army on taxation.
So let me take your uniformity argument for just a minute. They didn't think to address the uniformity because the taxes are supposed to be uniform. So let's say the 16th Amendment is, okay, it's part of the Constitution. It's being unconstitutionally violated because it's not being uniformly applied.
That's right.
Correct.
So yeah, because Article 1, Section 8, the last line says, all duties, which are direct taxes, imposts, and excises, shall be uniform throughout the United States.
Correct.
Okay. All right.
So I think I answered your question.
We've closed this, but the important thing we need to point this out because we need more people, folks. We need you to actually start helping people understand that under the Constitution, direct taxes were deemed necessary. I mean, that's what you've been hearing this whole time. The failing of the Articles of Confederation and why we were literally going to be under the control of France because, you know, hindsight being 2020, we now see that with France, from the French Revolution and France then being under the control of Napoleon Bonaparte, I think Napoleon Bonaparte, instead of going east into Europe, he would have come west into the United States to get his money.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So help me out for a minute. I'm still trying to wrap my head around this because I have always, and I could be wrong and I'd like to be corrected, I have always argued that the states were to collect the money from the people and then the federal government was supposed to collect the money from the states. Always believed that. And now, but you're pointing out here, and let me go back to it, that something which I had just previously never supposed, and I want to make sure I understand it. And I guess the audience wants to make sure I understand it because it's a mind bender for me.
Okay.
That the Congress has the power to lay direct taxes on the people.
Yeah.
which means that except for the IRS, which was created as a standing army, we have the militia to execute the laws of the Union. And except for it being not applied uniformly, what you're saying, and make sure I understand this, that the Congress had the authority to exercise direct taxes on the people And frankly, I'm choking because I'm going to have a hard time getting this out. That if applied constitutionally, the 16th Amendment doesn't violate the Constitution. In other words, it's okay.
Yeah.
Do you understand why it's hard for me for that to come out of my mouth?
Well, here's the question. The real problem with the 16th Amendment is, you know, there's a couple of real problems with it. The first real problem is that there is a question whether it was constitutionally ratified or not.
Right.
Okay, so there's that. There's the question, was it constitutionally ratified? And how will we find out whether it was constitutionally ratified or not is through Republic Review, because Republic Review requires a full audit. And each state has to do the due diligence of making sure that they properly ratified these amendments. And so that's how we can kind of go through. But I honestly believe that we have more than enough evidence that the original 13th Amendment was ratified. But that's a different rat hole.
Sure.
The 16th Amendment, the first problem is that there has been evidence presented that it was not ratified constitutionally. If that is the case, then it should be wiped out.
Okay.
Second problem with it is that it basically shifted, instead of taxing by apportionment to the states. Now, so what was a taxing of apportionment? It was basically using the census. So instead of using the census for apportionment, it basically said anybody that has income. So in other words, they didn't have to wait 10 years to basically, you know, find somebody that's got income, like a kid just getting out, you know, out of college and starting a job. When they start making income, that money is taxable.
Okay.
Okay. So they don't have to wait on census and that apportionment by, you know, the way the apportionment is handled by census, because the whole point of apportionment is they do it every 10 years. So they don't have to wait for 10 years. They can do it immediately.
Why can't they use the last census?
They can, but they were looking, and what they said right there in the 16th Amendment was that they weren't going to be bound by the census and apportionment. They had this power to tax income, which means that they could initiate it immediately on any and all income out there. Now, the only thing is that it has to be uniform. In other words, they have to levy out the tax that, you know, they need a 3% tax from all people or a 10% tax from all people. So it needed to be uniform because they did not touch the uniformity clause with that amendment. The other thing that they didn't touch was they didn't touch the execution. The Constitution clearly states that only the militia has the authority to execute the laws of the Union. So what they would have had to have done was they would have had to have actually, because who did the first tax collection in the history of the United States?
I guess it was sheriffs.
Well, it was the militia. Right? So it was the militia by the federal government. Because when the sheriffs couldn't get the whiskey tax, they actually had to call forth the militia and go in and arrest 24 men in the whiskey tax. And they were all tried of treason. Two were convicted. And so, folks, you know, if you don't pay taxes and it is a legitimate tax, you can actually be tried for treason. Well, actually, they would probably try it for tax evasion, because the reason these men were tried for treason is they weren't just not paying taxes. They were revolting and insurrecting. In other words, it's one thing to not pay taxes, but it's another thing to say, hey, you know, get out of here and use force to say, don't even come here. And so anyway, so they were not allowed to execute. They've considered that an insurrection. And they went in and arrested these people. So, to be clear, yes, they can tax directly, but the process, you know, does not include the creation of the IRS.
Right. Yeah, okay.
And so here's the question. See, because they forgot to do that. So in the 19 teens, when this was passed, what would have been the mechanism of identifying all taxes? And so, in other words, they didn't actually look at what they were going to do. They just knew that they were going to create the IRS because there's no way they actually went out and said, hey, we want to, you know, we need you to do these things for us, states, to make sure that you tax all these people so we don't have to call forth the militia.
Right.
So they had the intent of creating the IRS without even asking the states for that permission, because they had already gotten the states to completely forget, and they had already really gotten the states to abandon this concept of a militia, because the Dick Act in 1903 changed the whole concept of the militia in creating an inactive reserve for the Army and then later on for the Air Force. So, in other words, they almost federalized the militia in the Dick Act is basically what they were doing.
Okay.
They created the legwork for completely federalizing it, because when you look at, you know, the active National Guard and the active Air Force, or I should say, yeah, the Air National Guard, and then the inactive, I mean, there's no real requisition for Congress to call forth those powers. I mean, they're already in that service.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, they redefined the militia to be a national, under the national control. And they never amended Article 1, Section 8 to allow that to happen. Nor did they actually allow, because the states had full control over the militia, full control. Only right. When they were federalized, the federal government would have control. So they never, and they changed the apportionment and everything else. So they did a lot of things to the militia in 1903. And mm-hmm. It was in, and that was a part that was underneath the progressive, coverage of who? Teddy Roosevelt.
Mm-hmm.
I believe Teddy Roosevelt was in, because either that or Taft, that didn't matter. They were both progressives. And as far as Roosevelt was concerned, Taft wasn't progressive enough. But
Nevertheless,
they already started taking away, all of these checks and balances that were built into the Constitution. And mm-hmm. and the people were none the wiser at that point in time, because they just weren't teaching the Constitution. And this is when the lawyers had already seized this control, and they can do this. Yep, they have the authority to do this because judges said so, and the lawyers' guild, let's call it that, the lawyers' guild had already created this. This aura that, judges were the ultimate arbitrators, and they had the final say over what was legal and what wasn't legal. And that was never delegated in the Constitution either. The states were to determine the situations of cases, but they could not redefine anything. They could not inject and make something that wasn't constitutional, constitutional. They didn't have that authority. And so this is why, the courts have literally been able to redefine everything for us. And it's like, well, what's the point of having Article 5? It's almost right. Like they said, we don't need that anymore. But they've used it. So we're going into break right now. So believe it or not, it's right. Already time for a break. And so, folks, as you can tell, taxation is definitely a hot topic for many people. And more importantly, we need to get the dialogue right. The taxation is not theft. The taxation is a necessity, because governments cannot operate without money. That's what we've been saying throughout the ratification debates. And it is necessary. We'll be right back after this.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the republic review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you. As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416.
Okay, so what I didn't get out and what I didn't have time to say going through the break, bumper music, not only are taxes necessary and proper, but they're specific. So in other words, the federal government does not have the authority to tax us because they want to spend money. And that was what Wilson was selling when he actually threw out the 16th Amendment. We need to spend our way into prosperity, because he was talking about the necessity of spending more money. And they were already going into debt on spending money they had no authority to. And so the real problem was not taxation. He made it seem like we need more taxation so that we can spend more money. The fact of the matter is, the real problem was that they were spending money unconstitutionally. They were spending money on things they had no authority to spend on.
Wasn't there anyone back there who was pointing that out?
No. I don't hear. Now, that doesn't mean that there weren't, GRs and Paul Venables and so forth back in those days, but there's nothing in the history books that ever pointed out that. As a matter of fact, one of the things in the history books, which is kind of interesting, is that if you look at the freedom of speech and the first time a protest, a true protester was arrested, and it was by, is actually by a state official, was a state police force, I believe it was in California, and it was Sinclair Upton. Do you know who he was, right?
Yeah, you mean Upton Sinclair.
Upton Sinclair, that's right.
Sure.
Okay, so Upton Sinclair, he was a renowned communist. And he was using the First Amendment speech to speaking out regarding, government and so forth. But he was a renowned communist. And they arrested him for exercising his freedom of speech. And so this is where people were, I think people completely lost sight of what the Constitution was in this rigid compact. And it became, by the time this came along, the concept of a living Constitution was, everybody started accepting it. And this is how we have this living Constitution, this annotated Constitution, because that's what they're synonymous. The annotated Constitution is the living Constitution. And the federal government gets to change it and modify it however they feel necessary. And so anyway, the real problem had everything to do with the constitutional spending, and it had far less to do with the need for more taxation. They really didn't need the income tax. They were more than capable had they stayed within their spending. Spending already started getting out of control just due to the fact that the federal government had been subsidizing the railroad. They had been, funding the Department of Agriculture, the Department of the Interior, with spending money on parks. I mean, as they went down this path and, started spending more money on social programs and those types of things, where Wilson was really going to try to buy America into prosperity. And in some ways, he kind of set the system, because he did, he paved the way with some of the government programs for, as long as government just kind of, you know, cooled their jets a little bit, which is what happened with Hardy. You know, when Wilson...
Harding?
Harding, I'm sorry.
Warren Harding, okay.
Right, so when Harding got into office, Harding basically didn't change anything. He didn't undo anything that Wilson did. Not at all. He just basically let the economy kind of take off. And actually what ended up happening is we had a depression. I think it was in 1919 or 1920. There was a depression. We had this recession, whatever. And this is when Hoover, who was the Secretary of the Treasury, ran in. And as a matter of fact, Hoover was a Wilson sycophant. I mean, he was a huge supporter of Wilson's agenda, another communist in government. And so he went into Harding and said, hey, we need to spend money, because this was the first setup. This was the first financial setup that the Federal Reserve actually executed, to where we now had a downturn in the economy. And they were trying to create a policy to spend money to, you know, to kickstart the economy. And Harding said, well, why do that? You know, actually what ended up happening was, you know, Hoover was saying this. He goes, okay, I'll take that into consideration. And he sat on it. He never acted on what Hoover suggested he do. And then 6 months later, he kind of looked and he was watching it. And then 6 months later, he goes, hey, you remember you wanted me to spend this money? And looks, turns out we didn't need to. Boy, that was a bit of a big mistake. And so Hoover was just kind of standing flat-footed, and, you know, oh, well, I still think it would have been better. And he goes, why? I mean, it only took us a few months to get out of this.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, you know, so we had nothing but progressive presidents, believe it or not, from before Teddy Roosevelt, just a little bit. But, I mean, even going all the way, so we had big government people, but not progressives trying to create social systems. In other words, progressivism really came with the Fabian Society when they basically invaded us in the late 1880s. It was during the 1880s. And so that was the communist movement, because the Fabians were the communists from England that came in as academics and started teaching in higher education and started creating an educational framework of educating people on Marxist ideologies. Or communism. Okay. So, anyway, I digress. I didn't mean to go down this path. And what we really want to cover is what we're talking about. But we're going to cover a lot of material, and it seems like, wow, it's kind of redundant. But folks, what's important with going through most of this stuff is to prove the empirical data, and as they take a look from a different perspective of each of these issues, whether it be taxes, enumerated powers, jurisdiction, or what have you, we're really getting a very clear picture as to what the Constitution truly was. And the best way to define our Constitution is a limited, specified power of attorney. Because if it is not listed and not clearly enumerated and granted in the Constitution, the federal government do not have the authority to do these things. Even though the states are letting them to do these things, the states could, just as fast as I could snap my fingers, the states could stand up and stop all of this. So... Now we're going to cover the sweeping clause, which is the necessary and proper clause. I mentioned this before, but it didn't really come out in the little snidbit that we read. But go ahead and start that off now.
Okay. So because I only read the first sentence in this under taxes, right?
Yep. Oh, hold on. Okay. No, you read the whole part of taxes. You went all the way through the taxes. So we're now on the necessary.
Okay. The gentleman has adverted to what he calls the sweeping clause, etc., and represents it as replete with great dangers. This dreaded clause runs in the following words, quote, to make all laws which shall be necessary and proper for carrying on into execution the foregoing powers and all others vested by this Constitution in the government of the United States or in any department or officer thereof, end quote. The committee will perceive that the Constitution had enumerated all the powers which the general government should have, but did not say how they were to be exercised. It, therefore, in this clause, tells how they shall be exercised. Does this give any new power? I say not. Suppose it had been inserted at the end of every power that they should have power to make laws to carry that power into execution. Would this have increased their powers? If, therefore, it could not have increased their powers, if placed at the end of each power, it cannot increase them at the end of all. The clause only enables them to carry into execution the powers given to them, but gives them no additional power.
Yeah, you can keep going. Unless you got a question. I don't have a question. Okay, go ahead. I'm sorry.
Yeah, I completely agree with this. But it is objected to for want of a Bill of Rights. It is a principle universally agreed upon that all powers not given are retained. Where by the Constitution, the general government has general powers for any purpose, its powers are absolute. Where it has powers with some exceptions, they are absolute only as to those exceptions. In either case, the people retain what is not conferred in the general government, as it is by their positive grant that it has any of its powers. In England, in all disputes between the king and the people, recurrence is had to the enumerated rights of the people to determine. Are the rights in dispute secured? Are they included in Magna Carta, Bill of Rights, etc.? If not, they are, generally speaking, within the king's prerogative. In disputes between Congress and the people, the reverse of the proposition holds. It is the disputed right. Is the disputed right enumerated? If not, Congress cannot meddle with it.
Okay, so this is one of my favorite ratification debate citations because he really clarifies precisely the separation and difference between the powers of government and what they can do. Because he clearly lays out in England, all disputes between the king and the people is handled by determining are the enumerated rights of the people, in other words, the Bill of Rights, are those enumerated to determine whether the king is, you know, doing something that would be violating those rights. If not, then it falls, you know, underneath the king's prerogative. And when they talk about this, they look at the Magna Carta and the Bill of Rights and et cetera, all of these different documents to say, you know, are we missing something? Because these things were reserved to the people. So in other words, the only way you have to, you can stop government in England, or the only way government is restrained from doing things, is by those few things that you chose to protect yourselves with, you know, these rights or what have you. So in America, it's different. And he clearly says that in disputes between Congress and the people, the reverse of the proposition holds. Is the disputed right enumerated? If not, Congress cannot meddle with it. So remember, let's look at it this way, because the Constitution doesn't talk about rights. It talks about very specific privileges and immunities. The rights themselves are granted in the Constitution for the government to exercise these specific roles, responsibilities, powers, and possess these properties. All other rights, all other powers, roles, responsibilities are left to the people and or the states respectively. So you don't need to list all of the rights. Is religion mentioned in any way? No. Is, you know, personal behavior mentioned or personal crime or those? No. This was all left to the states to determine, you know, how to behave with their citizens, and states took advantage.
Okay.
So, anyway, so I think that that's, that's one of the most powerful citations there. I love citing that just for that purpose. So now we step into the next day, which is the June 11th, and right. Madison goes into an oration, and he basically talks about, well, it's just a note here, so just go ahead and start off with this because I don't get into it. So it probably meanders over a few different things, but go ahead.
Okay. I shall take a view of certain subjects which will lead to some reflections to quiet the minds of those gentlemen who think that the individual governments will be swallowed up by the general government. In order to effect this, it is proper to compare the state government with the general government with respect to reciprocal dependence and with respect to the means they have of supporting themselves or of encroaching on one another. At the first comparison, we must be struck with these remarkable facts. The general government has not the appointment of a single branch of the individual government or of any officers within the states to execute their laws. Are not the states integral parts of the general government? Is not the president chosen under the influence of the state legislatures? May we not suppose that he will be complacent to those from whom he has his appointment and from whom he must have his reappointment? The senators are appointed altogether by the legislatures. My honorable friend apprehended a coalition between the President, Senate, and House of Representatives against the states. This could be supposed only from a similarity of the component parts. A coalition is not likely to take place because its component parts are heterogeneous in their nature. The House of Representatives is not chosen by the state governments, but under the influence of those who compose the state legislatures. Let us suppose 10 men appointed to carry the government into effect. There is every degree of certainty that they would be indebted for their reelection to the members of the legislatures. If they derive their appointment from them, will they not execute their duty to them? Besides this, will not the people, whose predominant interest will ultimately prevail, feel great attachment to the state legislatures? They have the care of all local interests, those familiar domestic objects for which men have the strongest predilection. The general government, on the contrary, has a preservation of the aggregate interest of the Union, objects which, being less familiar and more remote from men's notice, have a less powerful influence on their minds. Do we not see great and natural attachments arising from local considerations? This will be the case in a much stronger degree in the state governments than in the general government. The people will be attached to their state legislatures from 1,000 causes, and into whatever scale the people at large will throw themselves, that scale will preponderate. I'm going to have to look that word up.
Okay. So, he kind of makes probably one of the best cases, preponderate, prevail, dominate, outweigh. But he makes some really important cases on the importance of the Senate being representing the states. And one of the things I try to help, emphasize in some of the work that I'm doing is the Amendment Protection Clause of Article 5 and how the Senate cannot lose its equal, or the state legislature cannot lose their equal suffrage in the Senate without their consent. So regardless of what kind of amendment they pass, if a state chose not to ratify the 17th Amendment, they were not to be affected because of that clause. Mm-hmm. Now, here's an interesting note, and this is by Mr. Grayson. And actually, he's an anti-federalist, but he, this point here is something that he's pointing out that he doesn't understand, because he's talking about sovereigns. And so go ahead.
So note to sovereigns. As to direct taxation, give up this and you will give up everything. As it is the highest act of sovereignty. Surrender up this inestimable jewel, and you throw away a pearl richer than all your tribe. Now, he's talking about direct taxation.
He is right here, yes.
Okay. But it has been said by an honorable gentleman, Mr. Pendleton, as well as I recollect, that there could be no such thing as an interference between the two legislatures, either in point of direct taxation or in any other case whatsoever. An honorable gentleman, Mr. Mason, has replied that they might interfere in the case of a poll tax. I will go farther and say that the case may happen in the judiciary. Suppose a state execution and a federal execution issued against the same man, and the state officer and federal officer seize him at the same moment. Would they divide?
Yep. Uh-huh. He goes there.
I'm sorry.
Well, this is what you call shock value, right? It's not uncommon that these guys would use a shock value, but it usually, okay, you know, most people don't recognize it. But go ahead.
Sorry, GR. Let me finish this sentence. It just caught me by surprise,
sure.
Okay? Okay. Suppose a state execution and a federal execution issued against the same man, and the state officer and the federal officer seized him at the same moment. Would they divide the man in two, as Solomon directed the child to be divided, who was claimed by two women? I suppose the general government, as being paramount, would prevail. How are two legislatures to coincide with powers transcendent, supreme, and omnipotent? For such is the definition of a legislature.
Okay, so I want to stop right there.
Okay.
He basically created the what was considered common knowledge of what a legislature was, that they are the power with powers transcendent, supreme, and omnipotent. In other words, a legislature is the sovereign body in government.
They're lawmakers.
Yeah.
They create the laws.
Yeah, I'm pointing this out because many people have a hard time when they, people are the sovereigns. Government cannot be sovereign. But that's not true. When we create government, we institute government, we delegate them powers that, you know, we believe they need, and we've given it to them willingly, and they become the sovereigns of that. So they have the ultimate choice. Are we going to war? They're the ones that determine that. And if you choose not to, they can grab you and throw you in jail.
Right.
But under our system, if you choose not to, you have that right as a, and what we'll basically call it, you have that right as a conscientious objector. Okay, so go ahead.
Okay. All right. There must be an external interference, not only in the collection of taxes, but in the judiciary. Was there ever such a thing in any country before? Great Britain went so far in the Stamp Act. Poynings Law, the abhorrence of the Irish, never went so far. I never heard of two supreme coordinate powers in one and the same country before. I cannot conceive how it can happen. It surpasses everything that I have read of concerning other governments, or that I can conceive by the utmost exertion of my faculties. I think he's challenged here by state legislatures versus the federal legislatures.
Correct. Absolutely.
Correct?
Absolutely. He thinks, because one of the federalist arguments is that this federal government is going to actually, you know, consume the states because they have all powers. And he hasn't fathomed the enumerated objects to which the federal government is limited. But he looks at it because they have the ability to tax. He doesn't understand, and this is why this is so it's simple, and I don't understand why he didn't get it. But bottom line, they can't tax for things they have no authority to tax for. In other words, was there anything in the U.S. Constitution that said the federal government could create and build a rainy day fund?
I don't see that.
And you know what that means, right? Where the government basically puts money away in case of an emergency. They did not give them the ability to do that. They only gave them the ability to execute these very specific roles, responsibilities, powers, and possess these very specific properties. And so they needed to have a budget on an annual basis of what it would take to operate, and that's how they would tax.
Okay.
So in a perfect world, at the end of the year, the outlays of the government, the money spent, should equal pretty much close to what they taxed people. Now, there may be a little bit of an edge in front of that, but nevertheless, it should balance out on the year. I call it the gazintas and the gazautas. The money that goes in, you know, should basically equal the money that goes out. And that money going out can only be on these specific things. And so it boggles my mind how Grayson was so dim-witted, so obtuse, to not understand that the government just can't spend money willy-nilly. This specific government could not spend money willy-nilly.
Right.
Right.
Okay.
Okay.
I learned two new words today, gazintas and gazautas.
Gazautas.
I wrote this. Okay. All right. Now, hey, we are down to Mr. Pendleton speaking of common law. Is that where you want to go next?
Yes.
Correct. All right. This is an important one. I know I'm going to have a question.
And we got 2 minutes left of the show, so let's get it done.
Of the show?
Uh-huh.
All right. I'll get the paragraph done. There will be deviations even in our state legislatures thus constituted. I say, and I hope to give no offense when I do, there have been some. I believe every gentleman will see that it is unconstitutional to condemn any man without a fair trial. Such a condemnation is repugnant to the principles of justice. It is contrary to the Constitution and the spirit of the common law. Look at the Bill of Rights. You find there that no man shall be condemned without being confronted with his accusers and witnesses, that every man has a right to call for evidence in his favor, and above all, to a speedy trial by an impartial jury of the vicinage, without whose unanimous consent he cannot be found guilty. These principles have not been attended to. An instance has been mentioned already where they have been in some degree violated.
All right. Okay. So interesting note, the little thing that goes beyond this. Now, Mr. Pendleton spoke so very low that he could not be heard. So anyway, so they couldn't take record of what he said next.
Okay.
So go ahead. What's your question?
These principles have not been adhered to. So what's he talking about here? He said these principles have not been attended to. Has it not been, is he trying to emphasize common law saying that we haven't been doing this?
That is correct.
Right?
Correct. At that time, under the states, common law was not actually being faithfully executed. In other words, the people's rights have not been guarded by the common law. So we got 10 seconds. So let's pick this up when we resume tomorrow. So thank you so much for joining us. And
thanks,
folks, you know, we're going to discuss common law because this happens to be one of the big problems that we're facing at the state. You know, every state in the union actually determined common law was to be the law of the land. And so with that, there are very specific things that actually are instituted because of that. And so I'm not the subject matter expert on this, but maybe someday we'll bring in some people that are. I'm G.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless.
To become a citizen, one must take an oath to support and defend the Constitution. Those of us who are naturally born citizens are obligated and duty-bound to fulfill the same oath, even though we're not required to take it, because it is implied upon us at birth. This is why I cannot emphasize enough the importance in supporting businesses who are supporting our Constitution. We have to stop supporting businesses that have chosen to hide behind political correctness, and obviously we must stop supporting progressive businesses who are working to undermine our republic and our Constitution. Do not let businesses or organizations convince you that they are supporting the Constitution by supporting protests for social justice. By definition, social justice is the distribution of wealth, opportunities, and privileges within a society. In other words, they're calling for socialism, which is incompatible with individual liberty and individual sovereignty and our Constitution. With that, please consider supporting businesses who advertise on this show and this radio station.